I've provocatively entitled this a tribute to my father, the anthropologist who hated relativism. And if you're not familiar with the term, one of the problems that when you work in the world of morality and ethics, you can just be so used to using this term that you can realize you don't realize that people may be unfamiliar with it. Relativism, in the sense of moral relativism, you deny that there's any kind of objective standard for right and wrong. Okay, that's what relativism means. So therefore, right and wrong are relative to the individual. If I go over to the thermostat, right, it's going to give me an objective measure of the temperature in the room. But if I go around and ask people, oh, I feel really cold. How do you feel cold? I feel too warm in here. No, this is just right. Right? How you feel, that's relative. That may be relative to your metabolism, your body chemistry, what you had for breakfast, you know, whether you put hot sauce on your eggs. That it's going to be relative to all that. Whereas if there's some kind of standard, now you'd be able to say, well, you may feel hot, you may feel cold, and so on, but it's 72 degrees in here. That's what that temperature is, even though, you know, you may feel hot, cold, or anywhere in between. So likewise, when somebody says morality is relative or cultures are relative, they are saying there isn't some standard you can bring to measure what's good behavior or bad behavior, what's a good cultural practice or a bad cultural practice. Okay, so I wanted to talk about my father because my father was a UC Berkeley trained anthropologist who worked in his professional life for the University of Alaska, studying indigenous peoples of Alaska. He did projects on Filipinos, on Koreans, on Australian Aborigines. He did a wide range of research, but he was a very controversial figure within the anthropological world because from the start, he was an opponent of cultural relativism. Now, any of you have been to college and had Anthropology 101, cultural relativism is the first week. You have that in the first week of class. So how is it that you function as an anthropologist if you are denying, you know, something that's considered a principle in the field? And look, he didn't go to some outre training ground for his anthropology. UC Berkeley is pretty much what you would expect in terms of enforcing the standards of the discipline. So how did he get there? How did he get to that point of mind? I mentioned as part of the teaser trailer for this presentation that part of the reason I wrote this, my father dies, as you see, about now almost 6 years ago, and I wrote an obituary for him for The Wanderer, because he had written for The Wanderer for a number of years. But in going back and reading this, I was raising myself the question, you know, every year when I teach the moral theology to Providence sophomores, overwhelmingly sophomores come in as relativists. Overwhelmingly, even though they come from devout Lutheran homes or devout Catholic homes, they come from admirable programs in religion from in middle school or grade school, but yet overwhelmingly they come in denying that there is some kind of standard that measures the good for human beings. That they almost all believe, and when I say almost all, I'm not talking about 80, I'm talking about 90% and up, believing that morality is not a fact, it's an opinion. It's an opinion because people can disagree about it, and if they can disagree about it, therefore it's not a fact. There were a lot of really crazy things I thought when I was a teenager. But the thing looking back that I began to wonder about myself, I was never a relativist. Never. The idea always seemed ridiculous to me. And so I spend a lot of time with kids talking them through this. But I am not doing something where, well, I used to be like that, and here's how I made the journey out of it. Nope, never thought. Even though I thought all sorts of wild things, if you recall, I was that kid who was reading Ayn Rand, who was reading The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged freshman year, going around putting the anarchy A on everything. Anarchy now! Right? Okay, so I'm not saying somehow it's all mentally on track. But I was not a relativist. And I think a big part of that was what I got from my father. My father grew up Catholic. He grew up devoutly Catholic. He grew up in North St. Louis. North St. Louis is a ghetto now. I remember him driving me through his neighborhood. Lots of it's boarded up. He went to St. Augustine's Parish. That, by the way, is that there are weeds growing in front of it because the church is completely gutted. It's not functioning as a church anymore. It's completely empty. They haven't torn it down because, you know, it's this historically beautiful Gothic church, but no one's going to it. All the Catholics moved out of the neighborhood. In any event, that was where he served Mass. He was not only an altar boy. By the time he was a teenager, he was a head altar boy. He was formed by, I want to say, Immaculate Heart Sisters, formed in the Baltimore Catechism. And for high school, he went to De Andreas High School, which was run by Brothers of Mary, now also closed. He was one of these kids who was really smart, and he would like read his textbooks at the beginning of the year, hoping that this was the year it would happen. You know, he always felt school was kind of boring, and maybe this year, this is the year it's going to happen. He would read his books at the beginning of the year, this isn't the year it's going to happen, and not do a lick of work afterwards. He graduated from high school at the bottom third of his class, but the nuns recognized that he had real intelligence, and they literally wrote an application for him to St. Mary's College in Moraga in California, and he got accepted. He borrowed $100 from his cousin Marcella, took a Greyhound bus, and went out to college. He basically ran out of money, and that's why he had to transfer over to UC Berkeley. Remember, this is the days when state schools were tuition free. Up until the early 1970s, the University of Minnesota charged no tuition. And that was true of what was going on in the University of California system. He said, I paid fees, but I paid no tuition. It's a tax-supported school. Why are we paying tuition? Something to think about. So he ends up at Berkeley, and he was an older student by the time he was at Berkeley because he had spent a year and a half at St. Mary's, and it was during that year and a half that he fell away from the Catholic faith. There are a number of people you can talk to. They went to Catholic college in the 50s and fell away from the faith, 50s and 60s. He got married. He got drafted. He served at the tail end of the Korean War. And so by the time he's back in the States, he just goes to kind of the local school. The local school is the University of California, Berkeley, and decides to study anthropology. And his friend suggested to him, because he says, no, anthropology, it's human culture, you can pretty much do whatever you want. Wow, that I'm in. So one of his teachers there, Silas Sherwood Washburn. Sherwood Washburn was the only anthropologist ever nominated to the American Academy of Scientists. So he was taught by very top-line people. He had Edward Teller for physics as a freshman. And the idea at Berkeley was they had these very high-ranking professors teaching freshmen because you wanted them to have the best early on. You want to have the best people forming them. That is not how modern universities tend to work, but that was the idea at Berkeley. And I remember my father telling me about having physics with Teller. So this is how he got started. He did his bachelor degree. He received that in 63 and finished his doctorate in 1967. When he was looking for his doctoral proposal, you're an anthropologist. You want to go to someplace foreign. You want to go someplace exotic. So how did this go again? He had the idea of going to the Philippines, and then there was some kind of revolution. Then he was going to go to Indonesia. And then Sukarno and Sukarto, There was this revolution in Indonesia. If you've ever seen Mel Gibson's film, The Year of Living Dangerously, that's about that period in Indonesia. Then he wanted to go to Chile. And then Allende, I think it was, this was the revolution with Allende and who succeeded? Pinochet. So, oh, forget it, right? He did his dissertation on a black ghetto in San Francisco, Hunter's Point. Fine, I'll just stay in the United States. After he did his dissertation, though, riots broke out in Hunter's Point. So, not because of my father's dissertation, I understand. It was just, this is the 60s, you know? You just have riots. Hunter's Point on the map here, it's this area right down here that sticks into San Francisco Bay. And the blacks who are living in Hunter's Point are the descendants of people who came from the South during this period in the Second World War, when all these factories were producing Kaiser Steel, all these factories were building battleships. So a lot of blacks came into the Bay Area from the South to work for the jobs. And by the time my father is working there in the late 60s, you're starting to see the kind of social dysfunction, social pathology that Daniel Patrick Moynihan was famous for reporting on. Remember, he was the one who coined this phrase, benign neglect, that we are dumping, we are channeling so many social services into the black community, and it seems to be making them worse. This is not improving anybody's lives. Remember, this was part of the project of Lyndon B. Johnson's Great Society. In any event, my father went in with the viewpoint that probably blacks are suffering because of discrimination, because of a racist society. My father had been active in the civil rights movement and was very, very sensitive to issues of discrimination. It's a talk unto itself, but when my father was 12, so in 1947, that was when Cardinal Ritter desegregated the Catholic schools in St. Louis. They were, and essentially it was overnight, they were segregated, and then the very next year they were desegregated. And Cardinal Ritter was somebody who made it very clear, if I get any pushback or any opposition, I feel completely within my rights to use canonical sanctions, including excommunication. He pulled out the big guns. And that was something that at a young age really impressed my father, because he knew plenty of people who were opposed to that, including his own father, who didn't want the schools desegregated. So coming to Hunter's Point in writing this dissertation, he has the feeling that, you know, blacks in many ways are the victims of discrimination. But as he kept working with people, more and more he started to feel these are folks who are not doing well because they've adopted a mindset and adopted a way of living which is really counterproductive and even self-destructive. In other words, what he was seeing was the breakdown of the black family. We're so used to this that we just think it's always that way, and therefore you have people who are gullible enough to think that this is the result of slavery, that somehow slavery was what destroyed the black family. Somebody who's really helpful to listen to about this, Thomas Sowell. Thomas Sowell talks about growing up in Harlem in the 1930s, 30s and 40s, and people will say, well, you know, Professor Sowell, you went to Harvard, you went to the University of Chicago. Isn't it amazing somebody who grew up in Harvard went to those kind of schools? And Thomas Sowell says, well, it would be amazing if someone from Harlem now went to those kind of schools. But when I was growing up in Harlem, Harlem was a neighborhood of working class black families that were intact. Black illegitimacy in those days probably was around 15%. As opposed to now the 70 or 80% that are 90% in some neighborhoods. These were intact, church-going, working-class families. So what happened was not as a result of slavery. These are things that really resulted from the best of intentions of social programming in the 60s. So my father will describe working with black families and black children, and talking to them about their lives and what they thought their life was about, kind of their social goals. And he said some of the best work, some of the best anthropology can in fact be done this way. He would dress as a street person, just dress as a bum, sit on the sidewalk and listen to people talk. And he would just kind of take notes. Whenever you interview people, there's always the danger that, in a way, they're telling you what you want to hear or what they think is interesting. If you just sit and listen to them, like with teenagers, you just sit and listen to them talk. You know how you have a bunch of them in the car, and you're driving along, and it's like they forget you're there? And you learn so much. You learn so much. Well, anthropology is the same way. But you would get these things that would come out in testing. There's a series of cards that are used in psychiatry. They're called the thematic apperception test, TAT. And there's a standard set of them. They're like black and white photos. Generally, they're hard to get, like look up online, because they don't want them out there. They want them people not to have seen them. And you give the picture to the person, they kind of make up a little story about it. So there's a picture, a standard picture in the set, where you have this boy who's sitting on, I think he's sitting on a chair, and there's a bed and there's a violin on the bed, and he's looking at the violin. And he said, "You, for example, if you interview the average Japanese kid, he looks at that photo and he gives you a story something like, he doesn't want to play the violin, but his parents want him to play, and he works very hard, and he becomes famous, and his parents are proud of him." That's a very common narrative. He would basically get two narratives in Hunter's Point. You would get this narrative of, well, he's expected to play that violin. He don't want to play that violin. Why the hell do you have to play that violin? Right? You get that. He's not going to play it. And then you get, oh, he played the violin, is real good, and he get famous. So you would never get a narrative where there was some kind of concentrated effort over time or difficulty over time. In other words, one of the things that intact families allow for is the development in training the child of kind of long-term goods, long-term goals and long-term goods. And especially where that collapses, people tend to focus much more on sort of short-term goods or short-term goals. And the idea of the long-term sort of vanishes. So my father was pushed off there's some kind of structural thing at work here. To seeing, no, there. When you have large numbers of young women who are having children at 15, 16, 17 years old, raising them by themselves, taking out their hostility and their anger against men, especially on their boys, and then having those boys be very defensive about their masculinity, such that now they don't want to form stable relationships because now that makes them look dependent on women. Well, now you have created a kind of a cycle of family breakdown. So my father finishes his dissertation. By the way, this is the period when I'm adopted. I don't think it's accidental that my father adopted a child of mixed race during the period that he's writing this dissertation on Hunter's Point. I was born over there in Oakland. My biological mother was white. My biological father was black. He was older. He was in his late 20s. My biological mother was 19. She was at community college, and basically this was sort of, how to put it, I was unplanned. And my mother could see that my father was not marriage material. The way that she explained it to me, I have some familiarity with her, but the way she explained it to me was, you know, in the late 60s when I was born, you could get abortions. They were illegal, but you could get them. And her feeling was that she wanted to be able to have me raised by parents who would be able to give me a better life. I could have gotten an abortion, but I wanted my child to have a better life. I'm probably not adequately grateful for that. I should be grateful for that every day. A child of mixed race, being born in Oakland in the 60s, that's for this unstable relationship, that's a great candidate for abortion. My father applies. He's married at this point. I'm adopted. And he gets a job offer at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And we move up to Fairbanks. Fairbanks is in interior Alaska. And he begins a very long career of studying the native peoples there, Athabasca. Well, I should show you this, even though I love this. I'd love to just keep that picture up there because, of course, all colleges are beautiful in the fall. That's why the college literature, you'll notice, it's always taken in the fall. It's never summer in a college. It's always fall. There we go. So what you're seeing there in the kind of reddish, purplish, yellow, those are Athabascan peoples. In other words, those are the Indian groups that that are native to Alaska. I can't just use, I can't just say, I'm not avoiding the word Indian. It's that this is this particular group of them. And I can't say native because you see the blue? Those are the Eskimos. Eskimos are native to Alaska, but they're not Indians. They're a totally different group. Eskimos tend to be rounder. They probably are related to the Mongols, whereas the Indians are related to the Athabascan groups, are related to different groups in Central Asia. They all came over that land bridge over there. You can just walk across the ice. When my father was first in Alaska and researching Athabascan groups and doing things like the thematic apperception tests and these kind of things, Rorschach tests, the ink blots, what he started to see with the Athabascan groups was something that was really alarming. There's a psychological condition that is called burnt child syndrome. Burnt child syndrome is where you believe that you are incapable of being loved and that you are incapable of giving love. That's what burnt child syndrome is. It means that you are the victim of abuse, psychological or physical abuse at very high level, over sustained levels. And he was seeing rates of burnt child syndrome that were just off the charts in terms of what he had for records for other groups. He was so concerned about his findings that he flew up one of his mentors from UC Berkeley, Bryce Boyer. And Bryce Boyer went through his data and went through his results. No, you're really seeing something. In other words, there was a lot of Athabascan child rearing that was just abusive. And what that resulted in was children who really were unable to love, unable to believe that they could be loved or giving love. Okay? And that was something I remember as a kind of a recurrent story, is you might think that all cultures out there have forms of raising children which are nurturing and affirming and all that. But this isn't something peculiar to Athabascans. There are lots of cultures out there where abuse, child rearing involves things that we regularly recognize as abusive. That doesn't mean that the only way to discipline children or that, Dr. Spock, you have some kind of conversation with them all the time about, okay, but this was something that was much too far in the other direction. My own father talked about one of the things growing up in St. Louis, growing up in a very tough, lower-class neighborhood, largely, again, immigrant neighborhood. He said, the thing I didn't like about that era was adults, any adult was always free to hit you. I just remember being hit by policemen and hit by... by the way, he did not have Sister Mary yardstick stories. His stories of the nuns were actually very, very caring people. In fact, he had nothing but praise of the Brothers of Mary that taught him in De Andreas. And he said the roughest they got was that they would lay their hand on you. Mr. So-and-so, you need to, right? But he said, I think part of it was the Brothers of Mary that taught us, there were a number of them that were former Navy pilots. Yeah, they got discharged from the Navy and they went into religious life. And so they would talk about landing a plane on a carrier. You know? Yeah, you have all sorts of clout with boys. Yeah, the moment you could sit there and talk about landing a plane on a carrier. So needless to say, maybe they got more buy-in. They didn't really need to discipline in those ways. He starts his research in 1967. That's when he started at the University of Fairbanks, and he had done a program in Alaska that was called the Bush Justice Program. In other words, how do you take American common law and now bridge the gap between Eskimo customs in terms of how you punish people or try people, determine guilt. How do you do that with Athabascans? In other words, they've got a very different system of determining guilt and doing punishment. Is there? Do you just say this is our way of doing it, tough, or is there some way that you can kind of mediate between the two, between the way you're doing it as an American and what their own customs are as Eskimos? So that there was a degree of success with that. So he was invited by the University of New South Wales in Australia to basically provide kind of input on a similar program that they were working on with Australian Aborigines. For that, so we lived in Australia. We lived in Sydney, and my father would fly out to all of these Aborigine communities. And at one point, he was going to have to be in one for a month, so I went out with him. That's where that red flag is. Ernabella Mission, smack in the middle of Australia. I was 6 years old, and and I was living. There were some whites. They were mostly English who were living there, but it was largely Aborigine. One of the things that sticks with me, there was a ritual that they do where these sacred totems are brought out, and they're brought out by the men. You are brought into manhood at around 16 or 17. There's a ritual that they have that's part of this, and the women and the children, uninitiated boys, they're not allowed to see this. So there are points in the ritual where the women and children all turn around. They're not allowed to see the totems, as it were, coming in and out. And I was told, you know, you're an American, so they probably wouldn't punish you, but you want to stay turned around. And I did, because there were men with, 8-foot spears walking around, making sure that all the women and children were turned around. Part of the reason I think that a lot of our students are as open-minded as they are to other cultures is because they know nothing about them. If your idea of another culture is, I go to Paris and I go shopping and they have malls and we have malls and they have malls with nicer stuff, You haven't really experienced another culture. When you're at some kind of ritual, the people are walking around making sure that you're facing the right direction, or they're going to spear you. That's a totally different outlook. That's just a different encounter, if you like, with a culture. There was a group of people that my father studied, focused on, particularly called the Yalnu. They're up in the middle section there, in what's called Arnhem Land. And he wrote several articles about it, and one of them addresses cultural relativism directly, so I'll show you that in a minute. The one thing I wanted to mention here was the thematic apperception tests, where you take your pictures and make up a story. My father said, it was only among the Aborigines that I ever had people take the TAT cards, put them on edge, and talk about what was coming out of the card. He says, that's the only time I ever had it happen. You know, and there you are as a researcher. Okay. Right? writing this down. I'll explain what that's connected to in a bit. So as he's coming out of this experience, there we go. There's Arnhem Land. And these are the totems I'm talking about. When he was in Arnhem Land, he met a fellow named Buramura. Buramura, at that point, would have been in his 70s or 80s, Australian elder. And when he was a young man, they had the kind of ritual that I'm describing to you. And the totems are kept in the woods, you know, where no one will see them. But every once in a while, people accidentally see them. They just go in the wrong direction. They end up in the wrong place. He's probably about 15 at this point. I think this is before initiation. He's talking with one of his friends, and poof, there's a spear that comes to his friend because the elders found out his friend had seen the totems in the woods. Buramura decides this has to end. You know, this is terrible, right? We can't keep doing this. So he goes into the woods and he gets the totems. Collects them all, and there's a community of Brits that are nearby, and he gets cement, And he goes in the middle of the night, he goes to the middle of the village, and he cements all the totems in the middle of the village. And, of course, the women, the child, everybody wakes up the next morning, they're afraid to go outside. There are the totems. They have to change their customs about this overnight. Overnight. And as my father's talking to this guy tells him, you know, looking back, I understand why I did that, but I think that was a bad thing to do. Because it really destroyed something that there was no turning back at that point. And I was angry, and I thought this was a bad custom. But this was really, it ended up being destructive. More destructive for my people, I think, than helpful. The way that he described Boromora, my father said, this guy was like, he had the genius of Aristotle, but it was like he was, I don't think this is a technical anthropological term, crazy as a bedbug. But part of that irrationality was an irrationality that really came, in a way, from his culture and from the outlook that culture had. What do I mean? This is from an article that my father wrote in the early 80s. By the way, I went to JSTOR, which is what we use for finding articles. I don't know why this didn't occur to me earlier. I did this a couple years ago. I put in my father's name, and boom, there are like five articles right there. My father wrote, I want to say, five books. Hunter's Point was his first book, and it just grew right out of his dissertation. He wrote a book on Eskimos. He wrote a book on Athabascans. But he had over 100 published articles. He wrote all the time. One of my memories of him just going out to the living room, he would be there at the living room, the coffee table. He would always have those yellow tablets of paper, and he had a calligraphy pen. And he would write longhand. My mother was a legal secretary, and she typed like 100 words a minute. She was like a buzzsaw, 100 words, 120 words a minute. And so he would just write things up and give them to my mom, right? My mom would type them up, and boom, another article off to the Journal of Anthropology or the Journal of Psycholytic Anthropology or whatnot. So here's as he was publishing things on the Australian Aborigines, this came up earlier with the Athabascans, especially with the Aborigines, he was talking about practices that they had being, the anthropological term is maladaptive. In other words, practices that are sort of counterproductive in terms of the development of a culture. And of course, in the anthropological community, he's getting pushback. Because the doctrine in anthropology is, whatever a culture has, they must have it because it gave them some degree of success. So you have there's no place for you to say, that's good, that's bad. No, it's almost a kind of pragmatism. What works for you? This culture did it, and it worked for them. That's your job as the anthropologist, is to just figure out, why did it work for them, right? Not to judge according to your kind of Western standards or whatnot. Okay, so here's a reply that he makes to someone who's criticizing him about this observation that he's made on this article in the Yalnu. 4-year-olds tend to tell stories that they make up, and at times are unable to be sure the event did not happen. By 6, a child still can use fantasy, of course, but it's usually fully able to tell the story is made up. Suppose a child is raised in a society where individuals believe that given objects in the universe, rocks, trees, etc., are actually some dead relative, or that a dream reflects an actual event, or that by telling a story or having a thought, you cause the fantasized event to happen. The Yalnu are such a culture. Do we really think that this does not retard that capacity for reality testing? Okay. How can you, right, buy into this set of beliefs about the universe and then really understand the universe? Okay, there has to be some way in which, in fact, you're able to say a culture might have tools which allow it greater access to the truth. Cultures may have things that get in the way of understanding reality or understanding the truth.
Just real quick, did Reiser think those things? This is a response to Reiser.
Yeah, because Reiser's, well, what he's criticizing is the kind of standard, almost like the who are you to criticize the all-new. You know, your job as an anthropologist is just to understand them in their situation, in their cultural setting, what pressures, social or environmental, guide them in terms of adopting those beliefs. You're not supposed to make value judgments. Those of you who have been trained in the social sciences, you're all familiar with Max Weber. Max Weber was the one who makes this famous fact-value distinction. Science is all about facts, what you can prove by data, argument, evidence. Values are judgments about right, wrong, good, bad, all of that. That is not scientific. Those things have no place. In a way, I guess, what I'm seeing with our students, when they come in the 10th grade, it's like they've all been formed in Vax Vapor. They have all been formed in the fact-value distinction. And you didn't give it to them at home, and they didn't get it at Providence, and they didn't get it at Holy Family, and they didn't get it in Ave Maria. But that's the environment. That's what's in the air. That's what's in the drinking water. Okay? That's the thing very often that we struggle with, I think, as parents. Our children are being formed, and they're being formed in ways that we're not doing, and the school isn't doing, and the parish isn't doing. It's from this other source. And it's a powerful source, because you see it when they come in. Okay. More. Art Hippler. I propose, this is from the same article, a basic criteria for looking at a culture as a human tool. Cultures are better or worse depending on the degree to which they support innate human capacities as these emerge. By such a definition, there are no perfect societies. We have probably never come close to producing a truly mature human or a human culture. But there is not much question that Euro-American culture is vastly superior in its flexibility, tolerance for variety, scientific thought, interest in emergent possibilities to any primitive society extent, certainly more so than the Yalnu. In the anthropological world of the 1970s and early 1980s, when my father was writing this, this is heresy. This is burn someone at the stake material. Okay? Because it's fundamentally wrong to say that Euro-American culture would in any way be superior to other cultures. You're not allowed to say that. But of course, notice the self-contradiction that goes on as a social scientist when you have to end up saying that a culture that acts against science is not inferior. You use a method that you believe to be the best method for coming to know things, and then you are unable to make any kind of judgments about cultures that operate in ways that would prevent them from using such a method. Okay, that's the inherently contradictory part. If you think about Walker Percy puts this so nicely, the scientist can explain everything in the universe except himself, the human being doing science. It's that human element that always gets left out of science. And then further, that human access to things that are, again, good, bad, right, true, false, noble, base, beautiful, ugly. Those are value judgments, but they can be real. And what has to happen as an anthropologist committed to relativism, you have to keep acting like they're not real, even though you use a method that you believe to be the best method. Okay. I'm sorry. This is from a different article. In fact, this is probably the earlier article that Razor's responding to. Ask the Yalnu how they feel about their culture, and their answers are revelatory. Women are intensely afraid of men and wish they could go elsewhere. Young men, in many cases, are not at all happy with the way their culture rips them off for an excessive bride price. All are terrified of the magic manipulated by the old men. Okay? The idea that somehow people simply accept whatever their culture gives them collapses once you actually start talking to people within the culture. Cultures are able to compare. Cultures, once they encounter different groups, are able to look and say, hey, wait a minute, they have this and we don't. Or, now, sometimes those comparisons can be favorable in the sense that, hey, I'm really glad we've got this thing because they don't, and look at them. But also you can have cultures look and realize they've got something working for them, which we don't. there, it is true that lots of cultures are, to use the term, anthropocentric or ethnocentric is the term. They're ethnocentric in the sense that our people, our group is the best. And it's true that you see that a lot. But it's not universal. To use something from modern history, or relatively modern history, one of the things that can surprise you when you pick up War and Peace by Leo Tolstoy, here's Russia at the dawn of the 19th century. All of the nobility are speaking French. When Napoleon invades, the Russian nobility have to learn Russian. They don't know it. Why? How did we get there? Because in the 18th century and the 1700s leading up to that, Russians were convinced that that's real culture, that's real intelligence, that's real learning, that's real civilization. If you're going to be a civilized person, you're going to learn French. Just to pick on the same culture for the moment, during the First World War, the Russians had a little bit of an air force, not a big air force, but they had some planes. The problem was when you had Russian planes flying over the Russian army, Russian soldiers would shoot at them because they were convinced they were German. They just thought, well, the Germans, they're so smart. They're the ones who'd be able to make planes. We'd never be able to put something in the air like that. Russians at throughout the 18th and early part of the 20th century, or 19th, the first part of the 20th century, had what we would call an inferiority complex. And there are lots of cultures like that. But in any event, cultures are able to compare and say, I wish we had that. Many of the Australian Aborigines that my father talked to, when they talked about marriage, they would talk about how they liked the Bollander way. Bollander is their way of saying Hollander. Remember, the Dutch were the first ones in Australia. So that's what they call whites. Whites are the Bollanders. What did they like about Bollander marriage? One man, one woman. Because what they had was polygamy. And what polygamy meant was these middle-aged, wealthy, powerful guys had access to all the younger women. So they have wives that are like 16, 18, 22 years old. Yes, yeah, some of you are making faces. But that's what polygamy means. It's these powerful guys who have access to younger women. Well, of course, the younger women don't like that, and neither do the younger men. So they don't just buy into that because this is our culture. They're able to see things in their culture and say, we don't like it. Well, that, as an anthropologist, you've got to be able to listen and say, you know, these people are entitled to despise things about their own cultures because maybe they're bad. Mrs. Bettina.
Well, this goes back a step, but given what your father was saying about some of the inherent problems with the Yolngu culture, did he ever find out why that man who put the totems out felt
Buramura.
It was bad?
Well, good. Maybe this is a good place to talk about that. This book, if you want a book that is a head-on attack against cultural relativism, against the idea that whatever cultures are doing is that somehow works, we have no other way of evaluating it. This book, Six Societies by Robert Edgerton. Robert Edgerton is an anthropologist at the University of California, Los Angeles. He wrote this in the early 80s, and he refers to my father a couple of different points early in the book. I showed this book to my father, and he said, yeah, by the 80s, you could get away with writing this. But when I was saying this all during the 70s, you know, you just got blackballed for saying this. But anyway, what Edgerton does, look at the subtitle, Challenging the Myth of Primitive Harmony. Think about Dances with Wolves, or if you can remember back a little earlier, A Man Called Horse. Remember the narrative? Disaffected, civilized man, cynical about his civilized ways, goes and joins noble savages. They initiate him into their way of life. He becomes whole, happy, harmonious. Civilized men intrude, make a mess of things. Reoriented, holistic man looks sadly at the savage way of life that's now disappearing, that allowed him to come to himself. Okay, there's like a template for this thing. That's one of the things that, in a way, Edgerton is addressing. We've got this view that whatever cultures, especially primitive cultures, whatever they're doing is making them happy and whole. And but when you look at anthropological literature, what you see is that there are all sorts of things that cultures are doing that are, again, maladaptive. They are self-destructive. They make people unhappy. They create friction in the cultures. I can't. There's a lot of this book that's a little edgy. It's very explicit about some of these, but there's a chapter that I used from discontent to rebellion, and I usually would tell students tell them that Boromura story in the context of that chapter. He gives examples of primitive cultures, or at least long-term cultures that haven't been impacted so much by the West, where people within the culture have pushed back, have rebelled, have said, we're not going to do this. Things like widow burning, cannibalism, war, constant intertribal warfare. These are things which were just a part of the culture. But you always had people within the culture who said, yuck, or no, I don't like this. And I would show that to students because I would say, where are they getting it from? Ultimately, they're getting it from some kind of natural law. They have some kind of natural understanding of right or wrong. Well, I'm out of time. But the overall point that I'm making here, anthropology and other social sciences have, quite frankly, for many years now, had the agenda that no way of life is better than any other way of life. But the thing that I got as a formation from my father was that, in fact, that was just not true. That treating children in a loving home was better for the children than beating them all the time or hanging them upside down as a form of discipline. There was an Indian tribe that would do that. Sometimes they'd hang them upside down for a couple of days. Stable marriages are better than having teen girls have out of wedlock marriages and creating generations of illegitimate children. That's not good for the children, and it's not good for the girls. That you're able to have a way of life that allows you to understand the world around you, that you don't think that it's all sort of emergent from your dreams, fantasies, and so on. That's better for you. That's better for a group of people who can do that. In an age of relativism, what it is that, quite frankly, our young people need more than anything else is an understanding that there are basic goods to human life. And when people don't get those, they're unhappy. When they don't get those basic goods, they're unhappy. And without saying there are perfect cultures or perfect societies, societies that are better able to get those goods are going to be better societies. And societies that greatly impede those kind of things are going to be worse. I'm sure folks have questions. Those kids are going to be in here because this is their study hall. So please feel free to come up and ask questions. Thank you.